The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ramesh. I think I may be a stranger to most of you, so I'll just give you a brief introduction about myself. I've been coming to Common Ground for about 11, 12 years now. I'm a psychiatrist, geriatric psychiatrist by profession. I do a few things here at Common Ground. I've been leading a workshop on mindfulness and physical pain for many years. Then I've done other workshops, mostly relating to the body, whether it's just the body or the aging bodies. And since last year, I've also been on the board of Common Ground Center. And periodically, I sub for Mark, just to teach you folks what it means to suffer. So this is a real life experience. And then I usually start my talks with the preface that I do not sit here as a teacher. I've stumbled through my practice for a very long time. And what I've learned along the way is that you don't have to reinvent those wheels. And hopefully I can share with you the challenges that I've had and hopefully share some learnings. And so essentially, this is like a support group for me, where I do most of the talking, at least for three quarters of the time. And as a psychiatrist, I don't know how to listen. I just know how to talk. So today, as you may have guessed from the guided meditation, the talk's going to be about keeping it simple. And this is something that I recognized the need for about 2 to 3 years into my meditation and my commitment to practice. It was that I had a whole library of maybe 20, 25 books. I was listening to Dharma Seed audio, Dharma talks 2 to 3 times a day. But then after 2 to 3 years of practice, after I felt like I had read a lot, my practice seemed to plateau. And it not only plateaued, but it left me with a sense of being clueless about what I was doing. I had a lot of ideas. My mind would go from one thing to another. I had collected a lot of information, but didn't know what to do. And then over the next, 7, 8 years, I discovered that this is not about my stage of practice at the time. It was more about my mind. It has an ability to create complexity on a very regular basis. And so what initially started off as, what's going on here, now has become a ritual. Almost every 12 to 18 months, I have to do some decluttering. And so this is a talk I give about once a year now for the last couple of years. And it's partly something I do every spring. It's like spring cleaning of my mind. And so that's what I wanted to share with you. And hopefully some of you may resonate with my experiences. So especially if you've been practicing for a few years, you may reach a point where it feels like, I'm pretty good at this. Mindfulness, it's easy. Watch your mind, bring it back to the body, and then you feel like you're going through the motions. So some of you may be really committed to practice, doing it every day, but then it feels like I've done it, been there, done that, what am I looking for? For some others, and that's where I was in the, the third, fourth year of my practice, it was like, boy, there's so much to learn. I'm finding so much about my mind. But more I learn, more confused I get. I hear things like samadhi, vipassana, insight, free awareness, or bodhisattva, pick your poison. There are all these buzzwords. And then you hear your friends say, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. You should do this. You should do this. And then you listen to 5 teachers and you get 5 different kinds of takes on what it means to be mindful. And then as you go chasing after each of these new buzzwords or new advice you get, you feel like you're spinning your wheels but getting nowhere. You're making a lot of effort. It's too much effort for the returns you're getting. And the more committed ones amongst you may stick it through, just building up more and more tension in your body and mind. Or like me, you just give up. So you go, fall off the wagon for a while, and then life hits you. You realize, boy, that was better than everything else I'm doing. So you reconnect to Mark, come back for a few Wednesday evenings, and get back. But I found there's an easier way to do it. You don't have to wait 2 to 3 years of this cycle and then fall off and come back. It is that recognize that this is a process that the mind does anyway. So instead of hoarding until your house is completely full and then struggling to clear it up, recognize as the junk is beginning to accumulate. So that the process of the cluttering itself becomes a mindfulness exercise. And then as you catch it early on, it's easier to declutter. So there are some signals. Again, this is just, as I said, it's my practice. But my hope here is that you would find some of the premise that I'm describing, and as you look at your own practices, you will find your own ways in which life practice becomes complicated. So for me, if I find that I've read a book one third of the way and then I'm going to another book, or I'm getting bored with one teacher and listening to a different kind of Dharma talk, or I'm going into neuroplasticity, or I go into, I'm going to do this parami for the next 2 months and then sign up for a couple of book clubs, and that's one sign for me. I'm a physician, so getting through med school and residency, etc., there's a linearity to my thinking. So there's a problem, you identify some causes, you do some tests, you come up with some differential diagnosis, and then you find a solution. Unfortunately, the grayness of life, the complexity of life doesn't lend itself to that kind of solution. So what happens is I go chasing after one lead after another instead of realizing that this is the messiness of life. So just let go of many of those things and then come back to what's really happening here. What's the cause of this restlessness? The other thing I mentioned earlier is you begin to cut corners. So I set the timer for 30 minutes, and suddenly my body is really aching by about 22 minutes. Today is not the day for me to sit. There are some days in which I can't wait to get to my cushion because the day at work has been so hectic. But as the minutes come closer to the meditation sit, all the energies come like a wall stopping me from wanting to sit. I want to do anything but sit at that time. So that's called resistance. It's one of the hindrances. And then eventually, either formal practice becomes like a huge drag because you feel like, as I said, you can just spinning the wheels, or it becomes like an automated procedure. Every day at 8 o'clock, you sit for 30 minutes. And it's all, you could even do it on autopilot. And you just go sit on the cushion, get back to the breath. Some folks are very good at activities like that. They can really, it's like the way we learn to drive. Initially, you have to pay attention to everything you're doing. After a while, it becomes an automated process. So you're really not doing any kind of wisdom practice. You just are going through the motions. But it's still a better thing to do than staring at the TV or the internet. But to the extent you're all here for more than just a wholesome habit, to the extent your idea of doing mindfulness practice is to understand the mechanics of this mind, to understand the mechanics of suffering that we experience in our day-to-day interactions, you really can't settle for a kind of a flattening of your practice. That means that's another sign that you're not really curious, you're not really inquiring, you're just going through another habit. It's like going for a jog every day. It's a good thing to do, but it doesn't teach you anything about your mind. So as I mentioned earlier, this has become a kind of regular part of my practice. So and by the way, people who are new to practice may not connect with this. If you're just fresh doing this for a few months, trust me, it'll come to you. But even very seasoned practitioners, folks who've been doing this for 10, 15, 20 years, who've done a lot of retreats, some teachers have talked about this. They get a nice buzz during a retreat or a nice insight, and then they get stuck on that. So they get hooked on, I need to have a steady stream of insights, and that shows them that they're heading towards some nirvana. And guess what? Their mind's always in the future and not here at the present moment. And this is another very common way in which our mind has this way of conning us into thinking that we're doing mindfulness practice. In fact, you get here with the intention of getting somewhere. And then as soon as you have that somewhere in your mind, you're there already instead of here. And then you're questioning, am I there yet? And so that's why the simplicity is so important, is that how much ever you try, that goal-oriented practice is unavoidable. So that's why it's a training that you have to do again and again, because goal orientation is what helps us in our daily life. If I want to come here at 7 o'clock, I have to make some plans. I can't leave St. Paul at 6:55 and expect here to be at 7. So these are, you know, like tomorrow I have 4 or 5 meetings and I have to make some plans. So those are good things in that setting. But when it comes to understanding the grayness of life, our reactive patterns, especially the nature of dukkha, it helps to pull back. So recognize that those habits are what they are, but this is also a good habit to cultivate against the grain, so to speak. And what was initially a very frustrating experience for me, every time I realized that I was stuck in practice, I was getting frustrated, now it's become a very wholesome, healthy opportunity for me to recognize what's happening. And as I said earlier, it's because of the way my mind is either wired or my professional life, it helps me to think in a certain way. I really have to be aware that my mind is doing the same thing during practice as well, the linear chasing after goals, and then have to keep pulling back. And so if I'm sitting and tomorrow is Monday, I'm going to have a busy day, and my body and mind are in a state of anxiety and some restlessness. So it says do something. And the doing something is reliving that meeting that's going to happen tomorrow. This is a meeting that hasn't happened yet, but my mind is reliving that meeting here. So I can't stop it because some of those meetings are going to be difficult. But I can recognize that at this point, there is this level of anxiety, and this anxiety causes my mind to get into a problem-solving mode. That's its habit. So I recognize that, I'm at the meeting tomorrow. Drop it and bring it back here. In the process, I'm not getting a whole lot of wisdom, but I'm not adding to the level of suffering. There is going to be a core of suffering because tomorrow is going to be a difficult meeting. But why should I suffer here right now when I'm with all these lovely people listening to me as if I'm saying something very interesting? but you know, it's an audience, so this is a good group. And why should I suffer instead of feel the gratitude and the support from all of you here? So this is a very simple example of how the mind can create a story and a narrative and a sense of urgency here. Do something when, in fact, I'm missing out on this wonderful, you know, soothing and calming environment. So how many of you can resonate with some aspects of what I've just shared? Okay. Good company. Thanks. So again, I want to reinforce the thing is my experiences are my own, based on my background, my personality, my work, but really encourage you to question. That's part of beginning a mindfulness practice. It's not just about sitting and watching your breath. It's essentially understanding the workings of your mind. And so whether you're driving in your car and you're stuck in traffic, as I said earlier, what is it about being stuck in traffic that is so outrageously awful that your blood pressure is up, your pulse is up, and your trapezius is tight like a Neanderthal's? No offense to Neanderthals. Please. So, I'm going to get into trouble. So I found that there are two kinds of complexity that arises in practice. So one is this agitated kind of complexity. So it seems to come from doing too much, trying too much, thinking too much, trying to solve the problem. And so, again, those of you who are very good at problem solving, either in your personal life or at work, you will see this, that you create this artificial notion of what a practice should be, what the process should be, and what the goal should be. And then you create a linear thing, and your mind is always everywhere but the present moment. And because your goals are always unachievable, because you can only get to your goals through the present moment, and you're not in the present moment ever, the goals are forever elusive. So again, you keep going through that. So one sign of that is the amount of effort you seem to be putting in for what everyone's telling you is a fairly simple practice. So that's one, that's the kind of agitated kind of complication. The other one is, again, probably folks in the earlier stages of practice may be prone to falling into this trap, is that, do I stick with Vipassana? Should I try some Zen? Should I try some Chan? Or what's the other one called? Vajrayana. And then you get into a community like this, and someone says, hey, you need to read Dan Siegel's book. It's really good. You know, his way of teaching is very helpful. The thing is, we're chasing after what works for someone else. So a book that, you know, a teacher that resonates with you may not resonate with me. And so, but if I go chasing after, so you'll find what's in my library. It's like half a dozen books, each of them with a bookmark somewhere along the way. But I can assure you, none of them is even beyond 50%. It's because a third of the way, the buzz has gone down. Oh, I've heard that, loving kindness, mindfulness. You know, most of the books have essentially the same premise. At the end of the day, the books are just signposts. As they say, it's the finger pointing at the moon. But we really have to look at the moon. And so sometimes either because of our conditioning or our just daily life, we really get bogged down in the finger. And are we getting the finger right as opposed to studying the moon? And so this may also lead to things like switching techniques. Even if you stick to Vipassana, as I mentioned earlier, one of the big kind of questions that comes up is, should I do insight practice or concentration practice? Is samadhi the same as concentration? What is insight? What is open awareness? What's free-floating awareness? What's wisdom? And you get bogged down into intellectual discourse as opposed to staying with the present moment. And for this aspect of agitated thinking, you really need the guidance of a teacher. You really want to connect with someone at the center or a good friend who's been doing practice for a while, because they can act as a mirror and you can see and they can reflect the kind of agitation that your mind is creating. And they don't have to do anything except point the agitation and the complexity, and things seem to start settling down. Because as I said, in the midst of this complexity, our minds are really well wired to solve the problem. And it's in the solving that we make things worse. The other kind of complexity is what I call apathetic kind. And I gave one example earlier, which is, you know, you get good at that technique and then you just do it in a mindless way day after day. And you can con yourself into thinking, I'm sitting every day 30 minutes, not a problem. That's fine. As I said, it's better than sitting in front of the TV or watching the internet. But again, to the extent the goal of your commitment to this time and maybe for the rest of your life, then you really want to get beyond this becoming just another habit, like going for a run every day. And so a couple of kind of signposts to this is there is the absence of energy. There is this absence of inspiration. There is this, if you remember what brought you here the first time, it may have been a friend that gave you some information, or you were in some distressing situation in your personal life, and then you read a book or an article, and you came and you heard lots of new things. You tried out some new things, and you really found inspiration. That's what kept you coming. If you come here, you know, on a regular basis, you will see there's an undercurrent of folks who come, sample this, and move on. Come, sample this, and move on. But if any of you have been here for more than 5 or 6 months, there is something more to it. You're not just samplers. You're folks who have a certain level of commitment, but then what keeps it going is this little zing, little energy. And I'll give you some ideas later on about, you know, how to do that. It's no different from a marriage. You know, after a couple of years, you know, if you just take your spouse for granted, then it just gets boring, numb, or you look elsewhere. But there are ways, even after 20, 30, 40 years, you can create this little spark. The other side is, so one is this numbing, so you just do it as an, you know, passive way. Or the other one is, the more pernicious one is confusion and doubt. And doubt is one of the 5 hindrances that you may have heard of in other talks. And this is not the doubt about, am I doing it right? This is the doubt of, is this the right thing? Is this worth my time and effort? No, this is a gorgeous summer evening. Some of you are thinking, what am I doing sitting here listening to this weird psychiatrist? Yeah, that's doubt. You know, whether it doesn't matter if it's real or not, but that's a doubt. And you can be mindful of that, because that creates a certain level of energy. And if you're not aware of it, that can start eating into you. Because this is a zero-sum game. Time that's allotted to us is a fixed amount. And we all have a lot of choices. Some of them are very tempting, some of them are aversive, and some of them are boring. So this talk is an example of boring. And then the tempting is outside, and aversion is something you're probably avoiding. So really watch this doubt part. It's a nasty hindrance. And so you can keep going through the motion, and then because you recognize that it's better than something else, but then it can eat away at any kind of energy that you may have to be curious about it. And then what you can do is practice becomes compartmentalized. And so this is one of the insights for me in the last couple of years, is that 30 minutes or even 60 minutes of dedicated sitting, watching your breath practice is, this may be a little sacrilegious, but just that 30 minutes of or 60 minutes of mindfulness, if not balanced out with some element of continued mindfulness through the day, is worse than, I wouldn't say worse than no meditation at all, but it can actually, you can con yourself into thinking that I am being a dedicated meditation practitioner. To me, in fact, it's better to do 5 minutes five times a day than just 30 minutes once a day. And so I talk about this especially during my pain workshops, or folks who have a very busy life. You know, if you have a busy work, you have family and other commitments, just setting yourself up for 30 minutes of meditation every day, you may even be setting yourself up for failure. And then some of you may beat yourself up for not doing a good job. And so that's the other part, is that it can, so you then tend to compartmentalize, I must do it, so you really, you know, adjust your life, and then you somehow believe that that'll be it. And so recognizing this, that's why I keep coming back to simplicity, is simplicity means it's a simple practice spread throughout the day. And then one kind of doubt that is problematic, especially for long-term practitioners, and those who like the metaphysical aspects of Buddhist practice, is those imponderable questions. Why do this? What is life? What lays ahead? Is there anything called rebirth? All those kind of imponderable questions. They're good for intellectual discussion or a glass of wine or so, but not core to mindfulness practice. You know, that again, you're slipping into intellectual, linear, thoughtful inquiry. There's a role for them because you can use them, you can use the curiosity of the inquiry to then come back and investigate. But if you substitute that for your practice, all you're doing is kind of intellectual exercise. There's really not mindfulness practice. Are you all still with me? Okay. So that's the background. So what do you do? So this, the part that I used to give talk at the end, I'm now realizing that I should talk about it at the very beginning. And this is that complexity of our practice is often a good mirror for the complexity of our lives. There is no way that someone can commit to fabulous, you know, physical activity, some yoga, some tai chi, some meditation, some book club reading, being a wholesome parent, being a wholesome spouse, dedicated to parents. There is only so much time available. And so some of them may be unavoidable. You know, if you're a late 40s, 50-something lady nowadays, you know, you have annoying teenage kids at home, you have a husband that doesn't help you around the house, you have aging parents to attend to, and you have a nasty boss that keeps piling on work on you. So for this, I mean, these are some of the patients that I come across. And so for them, the reality is, don't commit to 30, 40 minutes of meditation and then you beat yourself up for being a bad meditator. Nobody said you need to do that. So this kind of person, if they looked at their daily routine, they can find several moments when they can easily slip into a state of coming back to the body without, you don't have to close your eyes. You can sit at an airport or sit in your car, stuck in traffic, you can drop your shoulders, watch the tension in your back. You'd be leaning, if you're stuck in traffic and you're impatient, your neck's jetting forward, your back's off the nice comfortable seat that your car company has designed. You'll see all these patterns of behaviors that are adding to your tension. And you're not getting any farther. And so that's a great moment for mindfulness. So you drop your shoulders, lean back, come back to your diaphragm instead of your chest breathing. So the same lady who's, you know, commuting from work to picking up her kids for a ball game and then seeing her mom in the transitional care unit. She has moments, many minutes during her day when she can drop that momentum and come back to the body. So on one thing, so this lady may not have any option of simplifying her life, but I can say very confidently that at least 80% of the folks here have some aspects of their life where they can look and declutter. So one of those things could be our compulsion to pick up every book that either your friend recommends or Amazon says, people who bought this book also bought this other one. So do this. Save yourself some money as well and just really commit yourself not buying another book until you've finished your library. And then there's a wonderful library here. So pick it up, read, or just come back, come here, read maybe a chapter or two, and then that's enough. Beware of books titled with titles like 50 Ways to Simplify Your Life. Any author that can't teach you how to simplify your life with 5 or 10 examples doesn't know what he or she is talking about. And this is something, many of us who come to this practice are often introverts. And it took me a while to really see the value of what's often called having a dharma buddy. It's like connecting with somebody who is, along the kind of similar path and really forming a kind of a true open friendship where the other person can very comfortably point out situations where you're making your life miserable. And it doesn't have to be just your practice. It can be the complexity of your life, the clutter in your life. You don't need to see a therapist. You don't need fancy psychological training to see that someone's really driving themselves nuts by taking on too much. And so you just need a friend who can tell it to you openly. But if you have somebody from, the Sangha, etc., they can speak a similar language. And then you can help each other. And I found joining a book club is often helpful. But in the last 3 years, we also learned, I was part of the separate book clubs, that even though every tradition has its value, once you've settled on one tradition, stick to it, just because the language is different. And the words are different, the meanings are different. So, and this was at a book club of, fairly established practitioners. We picked Pema Chodron's book, No Time to Lose. And we really had a hard time because, we all had been steeped in this tradition for 10, 15, 20 years, and it was really difficult. And all of us admired Pema Chodron in her other books where she talks about more practical way of living, but this book was, hardcore Vajrayana kind of Mahayana Buddhism, and it was very difficult. We slogged through it for 2 years and then said, boy, never again. And so, but that's a teaching. So just be careful. It doesn't mean you can't read, but either you read it for intellectual curiosity, but if you want to go in for some depth of practice, then you do it as a commitment. You then do it for 3, 4, 5 years. And so many teachers do that. But don't do it in a kind of browsing way to pick up some clues from them or some techniques from another practice because you're getting bored here. A better thing to do is to watch the boredom. Is the what is it about this very simple practice that's causing you to get bored or distracted? So that's the kind of basic decluttering your life. The other part is those of you who are familiar with the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path has three components: so sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila is living a wholesome life. Samadhi is concentration, and panya is wisdom. So the first part is often lost. If you listen to teachers who taught in or either trained and taught in Asia, they'll say that meditation is the last thing that practitioners are taught. They're taught you need to create some wholesome qualities in your life. You can't be lying, cheating, gossiping, whatever other stuff in your daily life, and then go sit on your cushion and expect some wholesome qualities to somehow sink in. Okay. It doesn't mean you suddenly become a fancy saint. It's just, again, it's all about intention. It's all about creating a sense of direction and purpose to your life. And this mindfulness practice is just one aspect of that wholesome living. So this is, again, for me, mindfulness is divorced from life is just another habit. It really doesn't teach you anything about how your mind works. So, sila. So, there are many ways of looking at this. So, some of you may have heard of this this term called paramis. And so, paramis are wholesome qualities that folks are encouraged to cultivate and because they support your practice, but let's say more wholesome living. I don't know all the paramis. There are about six of them. Gabe may be able to help me out, but one of them is patience that I know. It's because patience is the parami that I'm going to practice for the rest of my life. But Gabe, do you remember what the others are? Loving kindness. Yeah, so there are they are less about mindfulness practice and more about just wholesome qualities that will help us in other areas of life, but especially, and these are things that you can practice on a daily basis. And patience has been just tremendously helpful for me because I don't have it, but I can see it over and over again. But I'm also I was gratified to hear from a couple of people who are close to me who kind of gave me the feedback that 5 years ago, this kind of a situation would have had you in a tizzy, and now you're just wound up. You know, so it's not like I'm patient, let's be clear. But, when you don't have any more hairs to pull, and you come back and, so patience. And so pick your parami. So that's one of those things. And then the other things you've heard of, the Brahma Viharas. Again, these are again, wholesome qualities, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, equanimity. But again, be careful that you're not jumping from one to the other. Between the Brahma Viharas and the Paramis, you have 10 of them. So if you didn't fall into the same trap, you could be bouncing around them and telling yourself, I'm doing Paramis, when in fact all you're doing is reliving the same, jumping from one to the other. And these exercises especially work well in conjunction with another small group, because these are just facts of living, and you want to be able to open up with someone you trust and exchange ideas about how to live a patient life. So that's the second one. The first is declutter your life. Second is create the sense of commitment to some aspect of wholesome living. And it could also mean watching your speech, and so I won't engage in gossiping for a little while. Good luck with that, especially if you're working or if you have a family. But mindful speech is, or wise speech is one of those. The next step is, this took me many years to figure out what our teachers were talking about, and this is the notion of intention. So for the many years, especially when I went on retreat, on the very first evening, that teacher would say, so connect with your intention. What brings you here? And I thought that was the most stupid question. I mean, I didn't fly halfway across the country without knowing why I'm here. You know, I'm nirvana or bust. You know, at the end of this, So at the end of these 10 days, there should be half a halo at least. And then two or three more retreats, and then, that's it. But I ended up with this shiny halo up here, but it's that kind. So, but it slowly seeps in. So, and there are many ways of looking at intention. So, and I'll tell you what worked for me. And this is, some things that I borrowed from some teachers, some from psychology. And then just as I put it into practice, it really has energized my practice. So, as I mentioned earlier, something brought you folks here in the first instance. Something keeps bringing you back here. But do we ever connect to that? And that's what the teachers, ask us. You spent a lot of time and effort getting to the retreat place. You could be doing a whole lot of other things in those 10 days, but you chose to come here. That's where you find the energy. That's where you find the motivation. Because by day two, day three, the thoughts are already coming up. What am I doing here? I could have been sitting on, some beach somewhere. Whatever else. When those nasty hindrances start coming up, you need to tap into the wellspring of this intention, this energy that took you to the retreat. So the way I have understood it and I explain it is, and some teachers call it primary intention and secondary intention. So primary intention is you create this intention, I am going to do this, because you believe it's good for you. Whether it's I'm going to exercise 4 days a week, I'm going to have ice cream just once a week, or whatever. But that's never sufficient, because New Year resolutions don't last for more than a few months. Because New Year resolutions are the classic example of primary intention. It's like you set an intention without a sense of why am I doing this. So for me, my favorite poison is anything that has sugar in it. And over the years, what I've learned is when I'm feeling stressed out, when I'm feeling distressed, boy, anything that's loaded with sugar, especially with some salt and fat and chocolate, yeah, you know, it takes care of my distress like that. So that wiring has been established for 45 plus years. I'm 51. And so, you know, the first 5 years I was an angel. And then after that, I became wise. And so if I, on December 31st, I say, yeah, I am, every week I'm only going to have cookies or anything laden with sugar once a week. Okay? Then March comes. It's a really busy time at the hospital because kids are all ramping up. And it's the end of winter, everyone's grumpy, and I'm having a stressful day at work, and I'm wondering, why did I decide to quit sugar? And every fiber of my being is saying, there are cookies, there's a DQ, that's open in the middle of winter, how nice of them. You know, let me show some gratitude and, you know, give them some business. So because it's not backed up by, so it becomes a one-to-one task. I shouldn't, but then my wiring says should. And then you eventually fail, and then you're back to square one. And guess what? When I give in, I feel bad. And what do I do when I feel bad? I have more sugar. Yeah. So instead of, I'm sitting there, I'll have a mini DQ or whatever, the blizzard. I'll make it medium. What the heck? Give me the whole big stuff. And then halfway through, as I'm satiated, it's the totality of the picture. The whole dukkha comes in. I failed. I didn't even enjoy this because I was snarfing it down with a feeling of guilt. Because I'm watching myself, right? So and then halfway through, I can't even eat this stuff. So I have to throw it. So that's primary intention. So, and that's why people who say, I'm going to exercise 4 days a week, they sign up for gym memberships. Everything becomes a painful act because it's not supported by a kind of a wholesome intention. And so the wholesome intention would be, why am I doing this? The kind of bigger picture that you want to always keep in mind. The other example that really comes, that I found more helpful is, those of you who are in a committed relationship, whether marriage or not. You know, it's so easy to be faithful, to have all these, you know, zingy ideas about, I'm going to be the best husband, best spouse, or whatever, best partner. But it's all easy when you're in the, you know, initial throes of the excitement of the first few years of a relationship. After that, things plateau. If you don't have that wholesome intention, at least I think that's part of the reason why we have so many dysfunctional relationships. Because without that wholesome relationship, the question arises, why am I not chasing after that woman who's giving me clear signals that she wants to go out with me? It's so easy if you don't have the sense of, I'm committing to this wholesome relationship, to making this person in my life happy. And on and on. But if you just said, I won't do this, I'll never abuse her, I'll never cheat on her, I'll never do this, without the sense of why am I doing this, then after a while the energy behind it fails and people start cheating. And then you can always come up with an excuse. And the same thing happens here. If your practice is not supported by this wholesome intention of why am I doing this, then after a while it becomes mechanical, or you cheat and you drop out and everything else. And so the psychology part, those of you who have some difficulties with bad habits, a book that I would recommend is called The Willpower Instinct by a psychologist called Kelly McGonigal. She's a Stanford psychologist, but she also is a big-time Zen teacher, so she does a lot of Zen retreats. But she talks about the same thing that I talked about in kind of three psychological terms. It's like you cultivate a I willpower. So this is about if you want to diet and lose weight, is, you know, I will exercise 2 days a week. And then there's I won't power, meaning, or you set some limits. So I'll have sugars 3 days a week, but if I fall off the wagon, enjoy that cookie, but then reinforce this sense of, you know, next week I'll come back to, you know, 2 cookies a week or whatever. But the bigger thing is, I want power. This is the sense of, what is it that I want? What is that longer term goal? What is the longer term aspiration that will make it easier for me to say no to that cookie? Anytime that opportunity arises, what is it that's going to help me, you know, desist? And there's more to it because, and that's why I mentioned this particular book, is because some of the meditation practice we talked about is also a habit. And so if you don't commit yourself to cultivating this wholesome habit, then you won't get to the wisdom part. So at some level, you have to go through the painful part of doing things that your mind is saying, hey, you really don't want to sit today. Why don't you go watch that TV program? So at that time, you really want to tap into your aspiration. That's the secondary intention. And secondary intention can be a commitment to your dharma buddy, or it can be a commitment to the teacher here, or you know, anything else. So you want to find something that brings energy, because what keeps practice really fun is curiosity. Once you lose the sense of curiosity, that kind of energy that you found initially, you really want to find ways of recreating that. And finally, I would say, again, to the extent that you're really committed to studying Vipassana, getting deeper into it, there are a whole lot of teachings. And I can say with fair amount of confidence that just picking one or two that resonate with you is enough for this lifetime. So chasing after the 5 aggregates for a month and then the 5, whatever, you know, there's so many lists, 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 4. After a while, you know, it just becomes another intellectual exercise that gives you a sense of I'm doing something without actually doing anything. So just, you know, connect to one or two foundational teachings or practices. So for me, there is enough in the Four Noble Truths, especially in the first and second. There is suffering is enough foundational truth for me. Because it's not that I have to believe it. I have to see the many, 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 many ways in which life creates suffering. And I mentioned this at almost every talk here. I've been giving talks, you know, professionally for 20 years, here for many years, but I know for a fact that on the drive home, my mind will create the story of, I screwed that up. I wish I could have, I didn't have said that. I wish I could have said that better. Now, those people who spent an hour and a half with me, blah, blah, blah. And especially when it comes to the guided meditation, it's a solo voice, it just feels awful. But that's what it is. You know, the way my mind is conditioned, it creates a sense of insecurity. To me, the reason I bring that up is, that's, to me, it's not the truth of the suffering, but applying it every day. I know for a fact also that on this Sunday, as I'm driving back, there'll be one jackass driver who will, you know, because that's how I'm wired. Even though of the 4 lanes, 3 may be empty, one guy buzzing past me at 80 miles an hour, immediately, where are the cops when you need them? Kind of thought. Because there's something about my conditioning that automatically gets outraged when some things happen. And it's my problem. It's not that person's. They're gone. And I'm still sitting with that. So to me, that's why I said, I can live for the rest of my life just watching dukkha and how my mind creates it. And then this has really helped me after, you know, 4 or 5 years of just listening to teacher after teacher after teacher, really coming back to, you find that you keep listening to certain teachers over and over again. And take that as a sign that you resonate with them better. And simplify that. So no matter what your best friend says, hey, try this book, you don't. I mean, one teacher can tell you enough for 10 lifetimes. You just have one lifetime here. So just be satisfied with what one wise teacher is telling you. Pick one or two books and then just stick with it. And anytime your mind says, let's go to something else, use that as an opportunity to look at the restlessness, doubt, the impatience, or whatever else. I think I'll stop here. As I said, I want to keep it simple. I can tell you a lot more, but let me practice what I'm preaching. So we have about 10 minutes. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them. Yes, ma'am, please.
Yeah, it seems like mindlessness is actually the default mode of the brain. And so I guess my question is there some benefit to it? Because you'd think that just evolutionarily, mindfulness would be better for us. So
Yep, I am actually, you heard the question, of course. So just about 3 months ago, I came across this whole little literature, and not widely discussed in neuropsychology, called the default circuit. So if you, those of you who have an interest in neuropsychology, this is actually neurology, it's called, you just Google default circuit, and you'll come across some interesting articles. And yeah, that's exactly their premise, is that when things are down, there are two parts of the brain that they found are particularly active. So whether you are driving, these are times of boredom, tedium, sitting on a plane, waiting for something. And so I think evolutionarily, it helped our brains to plan. And so, I don't want to get too deep into it because I'm still kind of beginning to understand what it is. But the short answer to your question is, yes, there does seem to be. It may have been a very late evolution thing for us more intellectual beings. And so, but then the problem in, it may have been a good thing when life was full of uncertainty, when you didn't know where the food was coming from, where danger was coming from, life was very short. Now with all the security of modern day life, but the mind still feels insecure and it still has to keep planning. And so in that process, we now feel more dukkha. But I don't think it's just, for a while I thought it was just a 20th century, 21st century phenomena, but clearly not the case, because when the Buddha started teaching this 2,500 years ago, people were dealing with the same problems. So probably it may be something more to do with the modern day brains, with the frontal lobe, planning, etc. But there's only so much planning you can do when you have everything already available, and then it's nothing but mischief. And so it's not a bad, like others have said, one of the best insights for me about mindfulness practice was to regard thinking as another sense gate. So if a bus goes by, there is no way I can tell my ears not to hear that, but I can tell my mind not to go chasing after it. It's the same way the mind's job is to think, and that's where the default circuit, when it's sitting here, bored, boom, it starts planning. And the planning often comes out of a sense of boredom, craving, aversion, or a neutral sensation, but something about the present moment is uncomfortable, leaves it feeling insecure, so it starts planning. So the idea is when it's appropriate, it's good to plan. So if you're in semi-busy traffic and you know you're going to be late for a 6 o'clock meeting, it's good to plan. I can take this exit, go make a loop, etc. But if you're stuck in standstill traffic, you're going nowhere, that kind of planning only causes the curve. So that's my take on that. Oh, hi.
Can you speak on, in the midst of not necessarily boredom, but like in the midst of like true sadness or true sorrow, how you like can get out of that pain and then reconnect to yourself? Or it seems like it's easier to do that when you're bored or you're a little bit anxious, but when you're in that space of just really sadness, how do you do that?
So just before this meeting, there's a social group that I was part of, and I was sharing with the others how much mindfulness became such a buzzword out in the secular world, so to speak, that the true meaning is lost. And often what you hear, even from professional therapists, is this notion that if you're mindful, you'll be at peace. Mindful is all about being with the way things are. So if you have a sense of profound sadness, what's happening is sadness. So if we do mindfulness with a view to the sadness going away, not only are you not with the sadness, but you created a fantasy, created a false expectation, which is not met, and then it actually defeats the purpose. The thing about mindfulness is that there is reality, and then there's our experience. So I think often Buddhism is criticized for the first noble truth, that life is suffering. My take is not that life is suffering, that there are things that happen in life and the way we relate to it causes suffering. So that ice cream example that I gave earlier, there is nothing inherently good or bad about having Häagen-Dazs or having a DQ blizzard. But depending on my mind state, it can either be a distressing experience or a pleasurable experience. So it's, again, the key thing about mindfulness is connecting with the way things are, but also recognizing the power of mindfulness and the limitations. So in the setting of an acute grief or an acute anger, you know, just something that came on, we, for all of us, those who, you know, especially those of us with, who are fortunate enough to have, you know, good psychological skills, we have to have several tools. So in some instances, the best thing you can do is distraction. So when you lose a loved one, the best thing is to be in company of others. To be mindful at that time of your sorrow and grief can be overwhelming. At that time, it may be better to have a bunch of people. And that's why we go through the rituals of, you know, memorials and service and food. But if the, you know, if the sadness or grief is not that intense, then a better thing maybe to do is cognitive behavior therapy, or cognitive behavioral skills. It's like your mind, when you're feeling a little sad, has a tendency to connect with all the bad things that you've done and creates a narrative of you being a bad person and you will always be a bad person. Whereas it skips out all the good things. And so that's again, I'm simplifying CBT here. So recognizing that this mind has created a negative view of this whole my life story and using CBT skills. And then if you're dealing with a more chronic state, a more kind of existential relationship kind of thing, then you can use mindfulness skills, not with a view to getting rid of it, it's actually connecting with the way things are. Because what you would find is that there is this core of sadness, but then there are layers of your reactive pattern, thinking pattern, mind coming up with stories that are actually adding to your level of suffering. The pain may not go away, but the suffering may be less. It's like, you know, personally, I'd say the way I'm connecting to the geopolitics of the, you know, since the last election. So much of my distress is, the reality is what it is, but my raging, whatever, my own reaction adds to my distress. Either I channel that energy to doing something, or I distract myself with other things. And so there are many, many other examples. So the key thing to remember is that this is just a skill, but has to be used very carefully. And any time you do, not just with sadness, any time you are doing mindfulness with a view to achieving a certain goal, you're not being mindful. And by the way, you're in good company. This is not just you, but all of us. And that's where the intention comes handy. It's like, even though the sadness may be what it is, what will keep me connected is this wholesome intention, because it will help me understand what is this movement of this heart that's making me angry or sad or impatient. We are close to the end, so thank you for listening. So I'll leave you with, just a reminder, please keep it simple. You'll make a lot of people around you happier as well. So, thank you for sharing the evening with me.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.